Okay, welcome everybody. Look at my special guest here. So this is actually the world champion of relationships, and she's the one who taught me what little I do know about relationships compared to her. I know a fair bit, but compared to her, I know bugger all. We just celebrated last week on the 9th of May our 45th wedding anniversary. So that would kind of say, at least on the surface of it, we know a little bit about relationships because we managed to survive 45 years. And look at us, no one's dead, no scars, no, you know, none of that. So all very good at that level. We also happen to have written a book on relationships, a workbook, run courses. How many times would we have run the relationships course?
Many times.
So thousands of people have gone through that. Made meditations, all that sort of stuff. So what we want to do is give you an in-depth look at a particular part of relationships that we think is critical for everybody to be across. And that's, what are your emotional needs in relationship? Because essentially we get into relationship because of our emotions. You know, we fall in love with someone. Love being probably the most powerful of all emotions, then what happens is we get underway. And so what we want to do is examine that today. There are a couple of house rules that we want to go through. So we're going to do a bunch of 45-minute sessions today. So we're going to ask you to be on time when we come back from the break. We're asking you to put your phones on silent so that they don't ring right through the system if they do ring, and to turn your video on where you are not going to lose bandwidth. It may be important for you to turn your video off at some point or other, and of course we've got you all muted at the moment. We want you to participate as fully as you can, because when you do that, we get a much more interactive experience. It's much more viable in terms of whatever, you know, we get out of it. The truth is, there's more information in our heads than we are going to be able to get out. And if we do a monologue, that's really not the best version. If we do an interactive version, then that's the one that's actually going to work. To give you a clue about how we've got ourselves scheduled time-wise, then essentially this is a new format. What we want to do is something that we experimented with another group and it went really, really well. So you are not the crash test dummies on this. In fact, you are the second group for us to run this. And basically what we're going to do is, we know that things happen in your house. You know, it's great that we don't have to travel to be together. We can have these virtual meetings, and they're a fantastic thing to do. However, you know, someone can crash their car into yours or out in the front yard, or all things can go wrong or whatever. But if you know that we are starting on the hour every hour, you can probably get things taken care of and get back and get into it. And when looking at the recordings, you also got a frame of reference for saying, okay, I missed session three, but you know, that's all I've got to look at. And you go from there. So this thing works really well. So that's our plan for the day. So no lunch break. We're just going to just power straight through. Because we get on a roll and it's good to keep things moving once we do. So the 15-minute breaks are there basically so you can get to the loo, grab a cup of tea, maybe a biscuit, and we'll go from there. So that's the important part to say there. If we start into the whole relationships thing, then essentially what you'll see is that most people in relationships say, you make me happy. And we reckon that that's a myth. That in reality, that it can't actually be true that you make me happy. And the reason behind that is there's a fundamental truth, and that is that I'm the one that makes me happy. It isn't Mary who makes me happy. You know, it's kind of like impossible for her to do that. The reality is, regardless of what she's doing, I can be happy or unhappy, and that's up to me to make that come true or not. So where we want to start with relationships is understanding that basic concept. If you understand that your emotional needs need to be met by you, not by your partner, then that's the big twist in relationships. But we want to walk you through how that happens for most people. So we've got a hypothetical here. So our friend Jane, she's raised by a dad who loves her heaps, but he's being clobbered by the mum. So the mum wears the pants in his family, and she runs the place with an iron fist, and dad kind of goes along with it because he doesn't really have a whole pile of internal personal power himself, and it looks to him like the best thing to do is avoid conflict, because whenever he goes up against mum, then the brown sticky stuff hits the fan, and she's prepared to escalate it beyond where he wants to go, And so she ends up running the show. What happens is that Dad watches Mum chew over Joan. So what happens is that Joan gets called hopeless and stupid and whatever, and she realizes that that happens when she doesn't live up to her mother's standards. In fact, typically what her mum is doing is living her unmet dreams through her child, living vicariously through her child's actions and whatever. And Jane's mother will promote Jane and Jane, what Jane's doing, to the rest of the world ad infinitum, but never directly to Jane. Jane never actually gets praise from mum. Jane's older brother realises that this is a hopeless situation, and as soon as he can get out of there, he does. The only problem with him getting out of there is that Jane feels abandoned because now there's, you know, there was at least someone, there was a compatriot, there was someone who was sharing, you know, the difficulties and those kind of things. But, you know, like most boys, he's just decided, you know, too hard, I'm out of here, and off he goes. And so what Jane does is she starts to fantasize about the emotions that she would rather experience. So she starts to fantasize about, guess what? Well, it's men who turn up and act powerfully and be strong and whatever. She also spends a lot of time doing what we call fantasy yearning. Now, you might have spent a bit of time yourself fantasy yearning. It's when you kind of imagine, you know, how I'll spend my winnings from Lotto. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if only I was with that person, or if only we lived in that house, or... Fantasy yearning is where you actually yearn for something that you don't have, but you're fantasizing about having it. Does that make sense? Okay, so she fantasizes about having beautiful things around her. That's because she feels poor and kind of left alone. And, of course, having someone who will protect her and look after her. So the short version of this is that she becomes a princess. And you'll all know someone who's a princess. I'm referring to it on a gender basis here. You probably all know somebody who's a bloke, who is a princess. So don't make the mistake of thinking that princesses have to be of the female persuasion. They can, you know, they can be of any gender and still run the whole princess thing. When we look at it in detail and say, well, what's it all about? Then essentially what happens is that Jane goes out and finds a hero. So we're going to call the hero Jack. So we've got Jack and Jane. So what happens is Jack is exactly the kind of person that she wishes that her brother and her father would have been. So Jack just naturally is one of those people who's, you know, he's opinionated. He will take the world on just because of, you know, just he will tilt at windmills just for the sake of it. He's actually quite strong internally, confident, very capable. Very willful, in other words, does things just because he feels like it, which is the opposite of what how Jane was brought up. So Jack is kind of like the opposite sort of person to what Jane is. So Jack goes to town on Jane, fixing up everything that was went wrong for Jane. So he surrounds her with everything that he can afford. Jack might be wealthy or he might not, but he will surround Jane with as much as he can give her in terms of things that she would wish for, and particularly he jumps in and solves problems. Now, Jane's not bad at creating problems because she's got a bit of a talent for messing things up. And as she messes things up, that provides a target-rich environment for Jack to get in there and fix things. So what happens is that they're actually happy for a while. And the reason they're happy for a while is that both of their underlying problems are resolved. But after a while, and when I say a while, it could be 10 years, it could be 5 years, it could be 20 years. It just depends on the circumstances. But what happens is that Jane suddenly starts going off. You know, she suddenly starts, you know, blowing a gasket when Jack is fixing something, another mess that she has created. And the reason that she goes off is that she's had enough of him fixing things, even though she's been begging him to fix things, even though she messes things up enough for him to have to be always fixing it. But what that does, it makes her feel like she can't fix it. And so one day when she's had enough of it, she just explodes and goes off at him about always interfering and blah, 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 blah. He gets extremely confused because he doesn't know why fixing things is suddenly off the agenda when it's been on the agenda for as long as he can remember. So she goes nuts because she's cranky with herself. As a side note, I would suggest to you that whenever you're cranky, the reality is you're actually cranky with yourself. It can be a target, and in our relationship, if there's a two of us sitting here and I'm cranky, guess who I'm cranky with? So that's a normal... If there's two of us driving along in the car and I'm cranky with someone, well, guess who it's going to be? So, but as a truism, as a student of personal development, you could say to yourself, you know, the truth is I'm only ever cranky with myself. I've let something happen that I don't want to happen. And the reason Jane is cranky and exploding at Jack is that she's feeling the powerlessness of not being able to make things happen the way she wants them to. And Jack fixing it is making her feel that way. So what happens is at an equal level, Jack starts inexplicably calling Jane an underperformer and hopeless. And the reason he's doing that is that he's actually a bit sick of having to fix all these messes that she makes. And he can see that she makes these messes kind of like subconsciously. It's almost kind of like, well, if you just woke up to yourself, you wouldn't be such a dumbass. And if you weren't such a dumbass, you wouldn't leave that bit undone. And now I've got to fix it. And I'm a bit jack of fixing things for you because you didn't have to create this mess in the first place. So what initially attracted them to each other turns out to be a bit of an issue. And that gets into their relationship. And really, neither of them have got any idea where all this trouble came from. So if we look at this, and I'm really just using one example here, really the problem stemmed from both Jack and Jane feeling powerless in their family of origin. You know, I didn't spend any time talking about where Jack came from, but essentially, Jack also was brought up in an environment where things seemed to be out of his control. And so what happens is that both these children feel like they don't have any power in terms of determining how things go. Now, a classic example is we've got our three-year-old granddaughter comes around once a week while we're doing the reno in the house down in Canberra. They come and stay for, you know, they come and stay for dinner on Thursday night, but they sleep over and they're still there Friday till lunchtime. Great for us, we love it. But the 3.5-year-old is going through this asserting her power thing. And so, you know, we make pikelets, then there's her pikelets and you're not allowed to touch them. And there's her train on the train set and it's going, no, don't you touch it, don't you go near it, you know. And I say, Granddad, fix it, no! All of that sort of stuff. She's learning what she has power over and what she doesn't. And so basically Jack and Jane come from situations where if they were my age, then they would have been brought up in an environment where they were told that children were there to be seen and not heard. And their opinion was irrelevant and just shut up and, you know, whatever. Basically, they've both got different reasons for feeling powerless. Once they feel powerless, this is not a good thing for anybody to feel. So what happens is that their reactions to feeling powerless are opposite. In other words, what Jane does is that in feeling powerless, she goes towards manipulation. What Jack does is he goes towards force and willpower and effort. So Jack gets loud and boisterous and pushes people around and, you know, in some cases can be called a bully. What Jane does is she manipulates things and she gets what she wants by subverting issues and pitching one person against another and, you know, quietly making this happen and the other happen. So Jack looks like a forceful, powerful character. He's actually trying to make his feelings of powerlessness go away. He doesn't know what to do with the situation. He feels hopeless. He's come to his wit's end about what to do about it. So he just starts yelling and screaming and telling everyone that, you know, they ought to grow up or get a brain or whatever. And Jane, who's never been able to get away with that, because any time that Jane got to be forceful and mother just went to town on her, then Jane goes the opposite way. So the important thing to understand here is that they're both suffering from the same issue, but they are dealing with it in a different way. They're dealing with it with a strategy that they develop when they're very young, so young that it feels natural to them. Now, the reality of this is that neither of these strategies actually work long-term. And they don't work long-term for the reasons I already explained about. We get cranky with each other because, Mary's supplying some need of mine that she's decided that, you know, I need this help or whatever, but I'm feeling like, you know, what do you think, I am an idiot or something? Do you think I can't do it or whatever? And so we have an argument about that. So the strategies don't work long term, if that makes any sense. Basically, what you've got now is we grow up to be adults and we bring adult horsepower to a game being played or developed by a six-year-old or a three-year-old or whatever. The reason that these strategies don't work is worth illustrating, and it really boils down to this, that if you're working against feeling powerless, you have to feel powerless. You can't be working against something that is not there. So when we're working, you know, when Jack is working to feel like he's got some power in the situation to make things go the way he wants, well, maybe things are not going the way he wants, or he feels like that needs to be done. In other words, if you think about this, you can't really be trying to make something happen unless you thought that was the antidote to what is happening. So this gets to be pretty powerful, pretty interesting when you look at it. Really what happens is that the strategies actually promote the feelings of powerlessness that both of these people are feeling. Now remember, I'm just talking about two people. There is any number of combinations of this. You know, when we look at a couple of people who get together, there's any number of reasons that are different to the ones I'm explaining now. I just want to use Jack and Joan as illustrations of, they're both suffering from the same thing, but they're reacting to it in opposite ways. So they argue with each other about what is the correct way to act about it. And that's the problem in relationships, is we argue with each other about, well, you've got it wrong. And so I'm naturally much more like Jack, you know, I'm naturally much more like, you know, if there's a problem, we're going to punch someone. There's a problem, let's fix it. If there's something going wrong, some idiot needs their attitude adjusted. There is much more like, we need to be compassionate, we need to be understanding, blah, 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 blah. We are both trying to get to the same result. We're both trying to get this person to be more capable, to be more effective. Mary thinks she can love them up, and I think that I can yell them up. And what Mary and I argue about in our relationship is whether she's right or whether I'm right. And of course, none of us like to be wrong. So quite often we argue from the point of view of, I'm not wrong. If I'm not wrong, I have to be right. And if I'm not wrong, you have to be. So that gets to be a problem in relationships when, in actual fact, if we looked at it, if we each separately focused on feeling what it is that we need to feel, then the strategies could quickly be abandoned. And what I mean by that is if I went to tackle my own feelings of powerlessness. You know, there have been many times when I felt like in my life where I've done my best and it's not good enough. So there I am and I've got a mess on my hands, and yet I've actually brought everything that I've had to the situation and we haven't got the result that we want. Then essentially what I need to do is turn towards that feelings of not being good enough rather than get cranky with whoever is around or get cranky with the situation, whether it's, you know, blaming people or, you know, all of that sort of stuff basically depowers me even more. So the reality for us in relationships is that we have to fix our own stuff. Otherwise, we put the pressure on our partner to do that. And basically what that means is that, you know, I will say to Mary, when you change your behavior, I'll be happy. What that means is I can't be happy until she changes her behavior. When you think about it, what that means is she owns how I feel. And this is a critically important thing in relationships. When Mary owns how I feel, I'm out of control. It means that I have no say in what's going on for me. And what I'm going to do is, if I don't like how I feel, I'm going to blame her for it and require that she change her behavior, which she may or she may not do. But given that we are creatures of habit, it's highly likely that she won't, which means I'm kind of up that famous creek in that wire netting canoe without a paddle. So if we take this to the next level, then essentially if we go back to Jack and Jane, essentially as children, what they do is they work hard at getting what they want. So if they work hard at being a hero or work hard at being a princess, then when they do actually get that right, when they actually, you know, pull that off, what happens is the feelings of powerlessness go away because they're getting what they want. you know, it's very easy to look at the 3.5-year-old, watch her throwing a tantrum and think, why don't we just give her the pipelets, or why don't we just give her the toy, or why don't we just whatever. If we do, then her feelings of powerless go away and she's happy. The trouble is we're training someone to throw tantrums to get what they want. So when we can make these things work, then they make the ugly feeling go away. So when we make the ugly feeling go away, then the feelings of being powerful turn up, or whatever it is, and therefore the whole thing looks like it's working. Hopefully that's making sense. Some of you nod. If I'm making sense, can you just nod or wave or something like that? Cool. Okay, so when it looks like it's working, then what happens is over time, those attitudes and those reactions and those beliefs become second nature, or what we call habitual. And each of you who are in relationship could predict what your partner is going to go off about. And in fact, one of the things we notice in counseling with couples is that partners pretty much sidestep or dance around their partners, saying, oh, if I say that, they'll get upset, they'll go off. And I'll either blow a gasket or I'm going to spend 3 days by myself. So don't talk about this. Don't mention that. You know, my mum was famous for, you know, my dad was a kind of volcanically erupting kind of a character. So my mum knew the things that would set him off, and she'd say, oh, don't mention such and such. You know, mum would give us money. And she would say, look, you know, she'd send us $1,000 and she'd say, but don't tell your dad because your dad thinks we're going broke. You know, my mum and dad actually had a lot of money, like shit tons of money. But they felt broke because I brought up through the depression. So my mum sends me $1,000 and this is kind of like, you know, 1,000 out of like 1.6 million. And she has to not tell dad. So she says, don't tell dad because if he finds out you got the $1,000, he's going to go through the roof and lose it. And he won't speak to me for 3 days and blah, 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 blah. Just take the money and run. And, you know, typically what we find ourselves doing is walking on eggshells around our partners because we know what's going to set them off. When I say set them off, I don't mean that everyone gets angry. They get silent, they sulk, they do whatever people do, we want them to not do that. And we modify our behavior to get around that. So if you get that, then you pretty much got the whole story. If we take that to the next level and move on, and basically what happens is whatever your beliefs, God or the universe puts these two people together. And the reason they get put together is that because they are attracted to each other, because what happens is in the beginning stages of the relationship, their needs get fulfilled. And so I don't know how long was it? Well, it was probably 10 years before we had an argument. It was kind of like, you know, this was when Mary and I got together, she was the perfect woman. I was the perfect bloke. Nothing could go wrong. Now, whether it was 10 years or 5 years or 3 weeks, I don't remember. But initially, there seemed to be no problems. And, you know.
Until I said no to buying a new car.
That's when it happened. We're driving home from school. So we weren't even married, right? So this would be in the first 18 months. And we're driving home and we put our finances together. And I said, I think we ought to get a new car. And, you know, like I'm a new car person, right? So I'm saying, I reckon we ought to get a new car. This one's wearing out and blah, 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 blah. Mary says,
I'd like to think about that.
And I heard my mother saying, you can't have what you want. Now, did I hear my mother or did I hear the lunatic in the passenger seat?
It doesn't matter. All these people need to know is we had liftoff.
We had liftoff, so I pulled over and I was yelling and screaming and carrying on about what a dumbass she was. She couldn't pick a car that was breaking down from a bloody stick or a boomerang or whatever. And, you know, why don't she listen to me when I've got the experience and she's got none and we need a new car and la, 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 la. In actual fact, looking back on it now, I can see that the baby in the room was actually the driver. And, you know, there was going to be zero progress, but I went ballistic. And so... That was the first time we came close to divorce, except we hadn't got married, so it was kind of a bit difficult. So what happened was, you know, until she said no, in the way that my mother used to say no, and I'm not saying we've all got problems with our mothers or our fathers, right? It's just that my stuff with my mother was unresolved, And so what happens is until she says no, I'm getting my needs fulfilled. You know, it's kind of like my mother was the worst cook on the planet. Like, you know, she's just terrible. By the time I was 8 years old, I could cook. And the reason I could cook was I was sick of eating the stuff that she served up. She wanted to be the cub master, and she said, Tuesdays you can cook. And so Tuesdays, when I was 8 years old, I would cook for the family, and that was the best meal of the week. And it wasn't because I was any good. It was because Mum was so bad. So I meet Mary, and Mary's a wizard cook. And I reckon the first couple of years, we never had the same meal twice. And that appeared to be the opposite of my mother. It was kind of like living in a restaurant. You know, how closer to heaven could you get than living in a restaurant, right? So I think that I'm, you know, that life is grand. And then she says no to something, and holy moly, it's nearly a punch-up. So it looks like my needs are being fulfilled. They're actually just being delayed. So if we move on, then what happens is, if my needs get fulfilled by my partner, then those needs imprison me for life, because I've got to do whatever it is to keep her doing whatever it is that she's doing. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So when Jack or Joan fulfills the needs of their partner, in other words, when Jane messes something up and that gives Jack something to fix, Jack gets imprisoned as a hero. He has to keep being a hero. He is sooner or later going to get sick of that. He might be 50 or 60 or 70 years old, but he works it out, because men are a bit stupid compared to women. But essentially, eventually, he's going to work out that he's a dumbass, not like major dumbass, and that he's been played all his life. And so he gets cranky about that. Really, the reality of this is what we need to do is we've got to confront our own feelings of inadequacy. The golden rule is, when you're cranky with someone, when you're upset with someone, when you're hurt by someone, then what's happened is your stuff has been trodden on. It's your partner who has kindly walked over and stomped all over your vulnerable stuff. The general rule of that is that they didn't mean it. They did it by accident. You know, the number of blues that we've had, where I thought Mary was attacking me when she thought she was helping me. We lost count of number of those, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Okay. So the whole idea here is that I've got to find my own feeling, my own neediness on the inside, and cure that. Because if I require that my partner does that, if I blame my partner for me being upset, I've lost the plot. I can't see what's right in front of me. And that is that I've got stuff that needs fixing, and my partner needs to stay out of it. So what we have to do is we have to unlock that codependency. And when we do that, we have to become aware that we brought it into the relationship in the first place. If you understand you brought it into the relationship, you'll also understand that you're the one who's capable of fixing it. And then what you can do is you can remove that burden from your partner. In other words, if we look at Jack and Jane, well, what Jane needs to do is that she needs to go where she doesn't want to go. She actually needs to explore those feelings of powerlessness that she has, that she secretly believes are permanent, so that they are resolved, so that they ease their way out of her system, so that she's no longer driven by that. This is for Jane to do. She's got to go where she doesn't want to go. She doesn't want to be found helpless again. So she pulls the hero in when she needs to be there. By the same token, it's a waste of breath unless we say Jack's got to do the same thing. So Jack's got to let her do that and go through his own feelings of powerlessness when he's not stepping in and being the hero, when he's leaving her to it. Because you see, Jack gets brownie points out of fixing things. And when Jack gets brownie points out of fixing things, what that means is if he's not fixing things, he's not getting brownie points. He doesn't feel good. He feels a bit useless. And because he feels useless, and men don't like feeling useless, what he does, he starts blaming whatever is around him for him feeling useless. Usually that's her. So that's where that issue comes from. So if you understand you've got to fix your stuff, just wave at me. Cool. So that's heaps of hands going. So that's pretty cool. I'm assuming that Bromin and Kay, I'm only just looking at you guys now. I'm assuming that you guys were just waving your hands or nodding your heads or something. Yep. Cool. Great. All right, so let's keep moving with this. So basically, really, when we, if you want to know what the number one problem in a relationship is, it boils down to this concept, and that is, we affect our partners. You have to make me feel valued and loved. If I'm not feeling valued and loved, it's because you're not doing something that I want you to do that makes me feel that way. And what makes me feel that way is worth exploring. So I'm going to recommend to all of you that you have a read of the five love languages, because that's how your partner will feel valued and loved. So some people get off on words of appreciation. In other words, they don't feel valued and loved unless their partner is saying, I appreciate you doing that, you know, I care about you, blah, blah, blah. Some people are just into verbal communication. Other people are into gifts. Other people are into physical touch. There are five of these love languages. We're not going to go near them today, because you can actually go to the Success Lab and get an in-depth look at it from there. Or you could grab the book and read the book. It's a really worthwhile piece of material, because it'll help you understand why your partner is talking double dutch. So effectively what we're saying to our partners is, you have to make me feel valued and loved, or you have to make me feel safe. You know, when you're not here and you're not protecting me, I don't feel safe. This is kind of like one of the worst burdens you can ever put on a person, is it's your job to make me feel okay and make me feel safe. I'm going to call it like it is and say, bullshit, it's your own job to make you feel safe. And if you're feeling vulnerable and if you're feeling unsafe, you need to do something with it. Blaming your partner for it is kind of like crazy. I'll just give you a classic example. I know it's extreme, and I know that we're not talking to anybody in this category, otherwise you wouldn't be on this call. But if you look at domestic violence, it's very easy to blame the person who's inflicting the violence. It's very easy to say, how can I feel safe when you beat me? The reality is, we have to take it into our own hands. And for me to feel safe when you beat me, is I need to remove myself from the situation so you can't do that. In other words, it's up to me. It's not up to the person who's violent to change. It's up to the victim to stop being a victim. Most victims won't stop being a victim because they go, well, I'll have to sleep in the gutter. There's nowhere to go. I've got no money, blah, 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 blah. That very same person 12 months down the track will be saying to you, huh, I left him. And when I say, why did you leave him? You told me that you couldn't leave him. They say, I decided sleeping in the gutter was better than sleeping with them. So they found the power within themselves to make themselves safe. So no matter what level you look at this is kind of like the bottom line. It's the kind of big message we've got to get. Is it's not up to Mary to make me feel connected to Mary. It's up to me to make me feel connected to Mary. That's fairly simple. The instant I go into, what can I do for her? The instant I go change from, can you cook me dinner, to, what could I do that would surprise and delight her? And I find myself saying to men all the time, listen, lame brain, haven't you ever thought that you should come home with a bag of prawns and some snow peas and a bit of garlic and throw the lot into a wok and get a bottle of wine and stick it there and say, your job is to sit there and look gorgeous. That's all you have to do in my life, is sit there and look gorgeous, and I'll whip up this feast for you and I'll serve you and away we go. And the reason I say most men are too stupid to think of that is that they're not thinking, what can I do for you? They're thinking, what can you do for me? And I want you to do the washing up, and I want you to do the washing, cooking, ironing, cleaning, and take care of any problems I don't want to take care of. You know, we're doing a reno at the moment. I will, you know, as much as I can, I will get the ringing of Bunnings onto Mary, because she's willing to put up with that kind of shit, and I'm not. And so I don't want to be on the hold line for hours to be told we've got none of that shit. And so I'll put the pressure on her to go and do the crap work so that I don't have to. Is this making sense to you guys? Just nod or wave or something? Okay. And if she says, no, you ring them, then I'm going to get stuck into her about, but, you know, I'm doing important work. I've got a chainsaw in my hands. You know, I'm doing the side of the house. All you've got to do is make a phone call, and I bag her for not wanting to do it. But as soon as I can say to myself, how do I feel more connected to her, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to understand that's shit work, and I could make a phone call every now and then. And I can say, listen, how about I take that load off you and I'll make a phone call. And by the way, since the 40-minute phone call to Bunnings. Was it 40 minutes yesterday?
45.
45 minutes mm-hmm. phone call to Bunnings was mostly being on hold. I can just put it in my earphone, stick my phone in my pocket and keep working with the chainsaw anyway. So essentially what I'm saying here is that it is my job to make me feel connected to Mary. I will only feel connected to her when I'm thinking about what works for her, not what works for me. So the same thing about feeling safe, feeling valued, feeling loved. In essence, what we're saying is that whilst we've got many needs, the researchers tell us that the big ones for us in relationship is I want to feel like I have status. In other words, I want to feel important to Mary. I want to feel like I matter. I want to feel like, you know, I'm one of the most important people in her life and that I count. I want to feel connected to her in as much as, you know, there's a bond between us that's stronger than it is with other people. And I want to feel safe and secure like she's not going to leave. All of these things, when you think about them, are just 100% bullshit. Because status, when you think about it, like if you can get status by buying a BMW, then obviously status is just crap. Me feeling good because I'm important to her is me feeding my ego. Me feeling connected to her because she does something for me is me feeding my ego. And me feeling secure because she won't leave is me feeling my ego. If you looked at the real world, if you looked at how things really are, status vanishes in some pretty extraordinary circumstances. You can get the world's wealthiest person, put them in jail. They've got no status. It vanishes instantly. It has to be earned in a different environment, et cetera, et cetera. You can get the person who's most connected and suddenly they're not. You know, there have been families wiped out just recently. You know, you look at the bushfires and entire families, you know, one person left. You know, who was the chef who's wife and daughters got burnt, they died in a fire, and that guy is horribly scarred. Some of you might know who it is, but anyway, connection can vanish overnight, and security, no such thing. The truth is, you know, Mary could fall in love with somebody else and vanish tomorrow, and if she did, I would wish her well, because what I want is for her to be happy. How I feel connected to her is by asking myself what would make her happy. Now, would I miss her? Yes, I would. Would I be lonely? Yes. Would I want her to go off with someone that she fell in love with? Actually, yes. How come? Because of that level of connection, because of that level of care. So when you think about this stuff, pretty much what it boils down to is that the first thing we need to get on our plate is that if you don't learn to satisfy your own emotional needs, then what's going to happen is you're going to remain incomplete and dependent and hooked to your partner in an unhealthy way. That makes sense?
It does.
Cool. Now, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, the thing that I think is critical about this is to understand that, Paul was giving the example of Jack and Jane, and the thing that is quite tricky about it is it's an unconscious thing, so we don't actually know that we've got a hidden agenda. And we don't actually have, I don't think we have an awareness that we've got any emotional needs either. It kind of hits us in a negative way. So we don't have an awareness that we've got emotional needs until they're not being met.
Yep.
And then we think, oh, okay. So the tricky thing for this is there's been a lot of research done, and I think Freud was the first one who started looking at this. Because it's unconscious, we actually, when we look for a partner, we actually are looking for a partner that is a composite image of the people that influenced us greatly when we were growing up. And that may not have been a mother and father. It may have been brothers or sisters. It may have been grandparents. It doesn't matter. But for you to try and work out what your emotional needs are, I think the best place to look is to go look for, okay, well, what was the feeling? What did I actually want as a child that I never got? So,
are you proposing that as an exercise right now?
Well, it could be a good idea.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. Let's get you to do that right now. So, take yourself back into your childhood. Say the question again.
What did you want as a child that you felt like you didn't get? So for me, I give you an example, for me, I had a father that was an incredibly hard taskmaster, and so all I wanted to hear as a child growing up was, good job, you know, like, you've done a great job and we love you and...
Well done.
Well done. And my father left the planet and I never heard those words, well done, in my entire life. So
from him.
So the thing that I wanted as a child that I didn't get was to find out that I did something right.
Or good.
So have a look and have a explore of just quickly now, what was there something that you wanted as a child that you didn't get?
And I notice as I flick through the video feeds that there's a number of you in second relationships. So you could add the first relationship to that question. So what was it that I wanted in the first relationship that I didn't get? And what you'll see, and I've worked with some of you guys for a while, so I actually know the answers already. And that is what did I not get in the first relationship that I'm actually wanting for my current partner to supply, which they may or may not be able to do.
And another way of looking at it, Paul, is to say, okay, well, another angle at this is, was there a negative feeling that you had as a child that used to repeat?
For example?
I just can't get it right. No matter what I do, I just can't get it right.
Yeah, but I met your father, and he probably died when we were together less than 5 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just that you never heard well done, you also got a lot of negatives. You were only a girl.
Yeah.
There was no need for you to have an education because all the girls did was get pregnant, have kids.
So for those of you that are listening, don't worry about my father too much, but what did you want as a child that you didn't get, or was there a negative feeling that you had that used to repeat throughout your childhood?
We'll give you a minute or two to jot that down. We're going to come and ask you, so have a think about that. The great thing about this program is that there's so many of you that I know that I've worked with before, where we've done at least this part of the exercise. Nevertheless, I see some of you staring off into space. This is the advantage of Zoom, is that if this was just a phone call, I wouldn't be able to look at you wondering, oh, you're back, Ange. Ange was just looking. Where were you looking, Ange? At the pool or the... Cool. Okay, so... let's just see what has come up for you. You don't have to have answers or solutions. The answer to the question was, what was the question again?
What did you want as a child that you didn't get?
Yep.
Or what negative feelings did you have that repeated?
Yep.
And this is just so that you get an idea of perhaps what the unconscious agenda that you brought into relationship was.
Yeah. We're not looking for what you should have done about it, or whether you should blame yourself or whether this makes you bad or any of that kind of stuff. We're just kind of realistically looking at that. But I noticed that there's a smile of recognition on your face, George. So you must have figured that out. So unmute yourself and share with us, mate.
All righty. So when I was a younger child at school, being sort of from an ethnic background, there was a lot of negativity towards being Italian, so it wasn't overly popular in the in my younger years, so that's sort of I sort of wanted recognition and like respect, and yep. So that changed later on, in years. But back then, that's probably the thing that sticks out in my mind. This sort of not being popular, or that wasn't a fun time. Those young school years.
And so recognition and respect is it for you?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks, George.
Cool. Let's go to somebody else.
Hello?
Hello.
It's just Dobbs. It's Dobbs in Melbourne.
Dobbs?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Well, the one thing I wanted for my father always, because he used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go fishing, and I loved going fishing with Dad. And very often I got up and I was ready to go, but he wouldn't take me with him. But he never explained why. And it was very many years later that I discovered that he was a preacher, he was a Methodist preacher, and he did most of his work with the parishioners in the boat or out in the river fishing, and I wasn't welcome because he was actually working. But he didn't tell me. He just said, "No, you're not coming."
So it was what was the feeling?
Rejection. I wasn't included in the one thing that he taught me to do and the one thing that I thought I did well, but he wouldn't include me most of the time.
Yeah, so not included. Cool. All right, thanks for that, Dobbs.
Right.
Ange, what was running through your head?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Mine was that, I wanted to connect more to people because our family didn't really connect to anyone, so there wasn't outside friendships or anything like that, because we were very wary of people, I suppose, and very judgmental. So yeah, that's what I was looking for.
Cool. Okay. All right, thanks for sharing, gang. So what we want to do is we won't go through everyone. We're gonna take our first break now. If you've made some notes, then that gives you something to work with when we progress further on. So thanks for sharing. We're going to come back. We're going to take the first break, which means that I'm not sure how Julie's got this organized. I think the transmission stays live and me and Mayor's are going to jump up, make a cup of tea. I recommend you do something similar, and we'll be back to go to the next step smack on 11 o'clock.